Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part two of episode 42, where we are continuing to discuss the Barbara Levitt and James March 1988 article, Organizational Learning, that appeared in the Annual Review of Sociology. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We've been discussing Levitt and March's 1988 article, Organizational Learning, and the article describes organizational learning and as a function of routines, history dependence, and orientation to targets. And now in this episode, we're going to talk about relation to the broader work and related themes.
So one of the things we hinted at in the last part, and I think would be great to expand here, is this idea that in the article, they talk very much about the individual level and the organizational level, but not a lot about groups within organizations, the variety that happens within organizations. You know, in some offline talks with our colleague Greta Corporal, we were discussing how the article actually recognized that there are different factors that shape the way different groups are going to experience different things that are happening inside organizations, but there's not yet this kind of fully fledged language to talk about maybe the different agendas, the different interests, even not necessarily in a political way, but how different kind of specialists are more prone to frame things in a different way. And to go back what we said before in the past part, Ralph was saying, there is not a sense of how organizations have different projects that might be competing, different departments, you know, busy with different kind of products. You know, that's the kind of, you know, variety that I think we could talk about and how this would change the way the arguments of the paper.
Well, one of the reasons I think for this is that because the paper is really about two things, organizational learning and organizational memory, is that the conceptual apparatus of organizational memory was not at the time developed enough, and it arguably still isn't, to incorporate plurality of memory, right? So organizational memory basically kicked off in response to two things, one being this Carnegie Mellon information processing property of organizations, that if organizations as entities process information, i.e. if they learn, if they carry with them information through time, there must be some kind of a memory-esque mechanism there. And early debates, like in the late 70s and through the 80s, that's where the paper is, where we are now, they're discussing whether memory is a metaphor for just a set of processes and characteristics, or whether it's an actual thing. And it seems that the debate sort of faded away and resurfaced with kind of a more IT kind of information systems hue as that memory is a thing, at least to some extent. And the other response to which organizational memory as a field emerged had to do exactly with the issues of turnover and how to preserve competitive advantage and information and knowledge capabilities in face of people coming and going to and from the organization. But the thing with both was that organization, in order for these kind of essential and still at that time basic interpretations of these characteristics that memory refers to, it has to be monolithic, at least conceptually speaking. In this paper, they introduce plurality, and we see different levels and nested attributes of organizations and power, but the field of memory, organizational memory, it's still barely there. In order for them to talk about this in the 80s, in the late 80s, it really wasn't possible. And if you have one of the main principles of your discussion lagging behind in terms of its coverage of plurality so much behind the other elements, I think that's why we're witnessing this weird inconsistency, where on the one hand they seem to be talking about how different parts and different agents and systems within organizations interact in these complex and interesting ways, And on the other hand, it seems to be stuck in this kind of plane of existence where organization is a single, either machine-like or brain-like entity that processes information in this linear cognitivistic way that we'll talk about in this part, like things like learning from experience. That's basically straight out of psychology or the retrieval processes that they mentioned. That's also fairly reliant on there being a single entity that does both the memorizing, well, the learning, the memorizing, and the remembering. And organizations are just more complex than that, but they wouldn't have the language, as you mentioned, or the theoretical frameworks to address that properly.
Demetrius, I'm wondering, on which of the two sides do you come down in relation to organizational memory? Are you more aligned towards the metaphor aspect or this idea that organizational memory is an actual thing that you could study and observe or be aware of? I mean, I've read some of the things you've written, so I have a suspicion, but I'd really like to hear from you.
Well, first of all, it depends on the unit of analysis and your interpretive lensing and blah, 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 blah.
All those important things, yes.
Yes. My overall position is both with regards to organizations and organizational memory is that it's not a thing you can identify or point at as a thing, right? So it's a phenomenon and it's a set of experiences, processes, maybe designs that can serve a purpose, but they're not... You can't walk into an organization and say, hey, this is an organization, and by the way, in that corner there is its memory. And, you know, that corner happens to be like a library or a server room or kind of the more traditional, stereotypical things that memory is associated with. In their own, it's not something that exists. And arguably, nothing really from what we're discussing can be... pointed at in such a way. So it's not a particularly discriminatory way of viewing organizations or these attributes, but I think it's an important thing to recognize that organizations and what they do is largely our interpretation of a number of things, be it practices, be it technologies or their application, or even what people tell us that they do in organizations. So I guess I more come down on the side of a metaphor, but I do, and in my experience both, so I do believe and I do see in my research that there is a memory-like attribute to a number of organizational processes. So in terms of consequences, yeah, it's definitely there. Not in every organization, not to the same extent, not to the same purpose, but groups of people who work within these socio-material environments towards certain goals, whether they're aligned or not, do tend to develop some memory-like properties to their work that are sometimes ineffable, but certainly phenomenologically noticeable. You know, walking into an organization and spending a bit of time there, you would recognize that there is something like that happening.
Yeah, I think you would, and I thought you. So it did sound to me like you go, you're largely on the metaphor side, but you do see that organizational memory, or your view is, if I'm characterizing correctly, is a phenomenon that could be studied or has attributes of being more tangible, but not in the way that a lot of people, you know, might think of that. Is that close?
Yeah, it's not any one thing that it's not. That you study this and that, and there you have a memory as a result. It's always different, and it's always context dependent. And I mean, the thing with metaphor,
right? And that's why I think it's fascinating the kind of research that you do, because it is all these different parts of it, and it's not just one process or this one attribute of how organizations do it. So it's many interwoven processes and aspects of how people relate to each other.
Yeah. I just throw in last thing before we can get back to paper is that the thing with metaphors is that, you know, metaphor still has to be a metaphor of something, Whereas kind of what I'm driving at is that it's a nothing, you know, it's nothing. It's not any one thing that you could identify. So in that sense, I'm not really on the metaphor side in so much as I'm on the consequentialist side that, you know, if I have to pick sides, that it's not that memory is just a symbol or like a signifier for something that we can't maybe articulate. It's kind of more complex and more fluid, emergent than that. And here the field is not there for them to be able to articulate this in a meaningful way.
Well, speaking of a metaphor, let me ask this question, Dimitris. Organizational memory in whatever form, is it just by nature not very durable? Individuals obviously forget over time. As organizations, do they forget faster than individuals? There's a reason why I'm asking that.
That depends on so many things. What are you driving at?
Well, what I'm actually kind of moving towards was this question about, we're talking about organization learning. There's the metaphor of the learning organization, which became very popular sometime after this article, or maybe it was around the same time as this article. And what I understood of what was trying to be proffered as a learning organization was this notion that the organization has some sort of a conscientiousness towards capturing what are good practices, what are good experiences, what are good routines to form, and discarding the bad ones. And the process of enacting that process included greater participation. That was kind of Senge's approach. And there was a strong valence attached to that the learning organization was going to produce greater outcomes because it had a better sense of who it was, how it did business, that it made good choices rather than bad choices. The outcomes would be better. But in practice, the question that I sort of have is that, well, if organizational memory is really captured in individuals and we don't buy into the idea that information technologies have the ability to capture the same type of information that would either supplant, replicate, or supplement an individual's memory, what does that say for really, the whole discussion about learning organizations, whether or not it's a real thing?
Yeah, it's very loaded. Yes.
I'm adamant that organizations can't remember, individuals remember. So in the sense of memory verbatim, like literal memory, that I don't see why we would think that these abstract entities would have the same, could do the same things that individuals do. We have a brain, we can point at where memory is, sort of, and we can describe how the interpretation of it goes and subject to what and that kind of thing. We can't do that with organizations. That's why it's a metaphor. What does kind of enable the learning organization and organizational memory as such is more to do with the structures, technologies, artifacts, and processes to which certain ways of doing things stick. Now, here in this paper, they just piled it all up under the routines term, which is why I was a bit iffy with when I was reading out the everything that is involved in routines in part one. You can't just dump everything and call it routines, okay? You know, there are some things that are so different and so distinct there that do actually play into memory or to what an organization is. And just by saying that, hey, you see this, that's everything, and let's call it routines, it loses a lot of sensitivity. But that being said,
that's a good point. It's like the garbage can model of routines.
Yeah, it's just a garbage can, really. And that being said, I mean, they weren't setting out to develop a theory of organizational memory, but kind of since we're at it, and this is controversial, right? So this isn't, to our listeners, this isn't a statement of fact. This is kind of the direction that I'm working in, and there's plenty of people who would disagree or approach this differently, but since you don't have the benefit of listening to them.
You have to take our view.
Yeah. Kind of my position is that certain tools of work, certain processes, practices, even organizational designs, both as, architecturally speaking and hierarchically speaking, they, some of them are sticky to memory. So certain ways of doing things, let's say like routines, but in a more constrained way, they stick to spaces, they stick to objects, they stick to communication technologies, whether that's digital communication or just, a post-it note that passes around the office. And that enacts, well, that is what individuals in organizations use to enact something like a memory. That's kind of where I stand with respect to all these learning organizations and organizational memory types of concepts, that they have legitimacy, but maybe not quite as literal as the name would suggest.
So, Tom, how does that address your... Was that your ulterior motive as learning organizations, or did you have something else you were thinking about memory?
Oh, I'm definitely with him, because especially when he started talking about the architectural side. I mean, one of the things that I've always contended with in very, very large distributed organizations is that how the concepts of, or the routines or what have you, are just... they become compartmentalized by building.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point.
Or by physical location. And the memory and the whole idea of memory is the way in which it's sort of addressed in the article here is it's kind of singular. But of course, when you have organizations that are that compartmentalized or perhaps functionally compartmentalized, each has its own conception of an organizational memory or its own set of routines. And there's not that much, unless there's a reason to bridge from one compartment to another, those memories just kind of stay local and they atrophy very quickly. In the case of if you have turnover or changes of context, you can, unlearn a lot of things fairly quickly.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate because, that's my role in the podcast. So, because this links with what I was talking at the beginning on this idea that, and Dimitris hinted at that as well, on how the paper very much talks about this monolithic view of organizations. And, nowadays we have a more understanding of the plurality, the variety, the different kind of departments and projects. And we talked about physical space and how that, in case of the large organizations, kind of cuts across and constrains action and, we may say, learning. But I was thinking, I don't see that necessarily as a problem. You can also argue the other way around and say that actually in organizations, what you have is many learnings happening in different kind of communities. Think of all the discussions about communities of practice and how people, in this case, learn and share ideas within people that are part of the same kind of, practice or occupational, or, we can even expand that and say that people that are involved in specific kind of general task, like different products that the organization is producing. So in a way, the fact that the learning is constrained is not necessarily, we don't have to think that the one that happens at the organizational level is enduring and strong. It can be the other way around. The one that's more localized and distributed, can actually be the one enduring because it's attached to the very work that is being done. Am I making any sense?
You are, but how are you being the devil's advocate here?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not seeing the devil part.
Yeah, you seem to be agreeing with everything that we just said.
Yes, but I think Tone was hitting at the fact that if the learning happens in a specific place in time, like in a department and not in the other, then it doesn't has the same kind of, endurance as it would have if it was shared across the organization. I think that's what I'm disagreeing.
Well, okay, I see the point. Another thing I was kind of thinking of, and maybe this will help. This will help is, like, let's say that we have an extraordinary experience, and extraordinary experience could be like a crisis or something that happens unusual to the organization that might ordinarily cause it to need to routinize something new, but doesn't. Okay, and there's so many. So many different reasons why that might occur, because it's viewed as an extraordinary circumstance, and therefore a belief may arise that says that, well, this is never going to happen again. So we don't actually have to change our routines in order to go with that. And so that those are potentially useful lessons, especially if indeed the crisis does repeat. These are useful lessons that just flat disappear instantly. It's like we don't even commit them to memory. We just say, all right, that was then. We're back to normal, and we're going to go, our happy, merrily way using the processes that we're already comfortable with. And so, obviously the learning organization, that was one of the things that it was, that whole conception was trying to break, to try to get organizations to diverge its thinking a little bit more, to welcome in more perspectives and be a little bit more amenable to taking these new disparate or unusual experiences and making better use of them. But in terms of how that translates into practice, I don't always see that.
Well, so this makes me think of the higher liability organizing, and one of the tenets that are outlined by Wyke and Sutcliffe is reluctance to simplify. And it's precisely this notion that Tom mentioned, where people have this tendency to say, oh, that was just an anomaly, or it's not really pertinent to the work we do, or things are really better, so look over in this corner, don't pay any attention to that. That is one of the hallmarks of high reliability, where they actually complexify the learning and make group and individual, but also roll into the group choices about what are we going to pay attention to, and maybe this small weak signal or small problem we had, yes, maybe not a problem, not a big issue, a crisis on its own, but it's a harbinger of something else or an information we can use about how the system works. And that's actually one of the key distinguishing characteristics of high reliability organizing, is the willingness of people in the organization to make that kind of a choice.
I think something else that might make what Tom's thesis more academically recognizable is to call it project-based knowledge transfer, which I think is basically, because that's been a big thing once, I think in starting early 90s and up until 2010-ish or so. How do we take the learning that happens locally in projects and that's really intensive and really topical, and how do we distribute that to the wider organization? And one of the kind of precarious characteristics of projects is that the organizational memory and learning that is developed within them is extremely fragile and usually doesn't survive transportation well. And there is a whole thing about project amnesia that's actually it. Project amnesia is the term to do with organizational memory and failure of it in the project context, right? And a lot of work has been done on how can we codify learnings and memory that happens within projects in such a way that it's not rejected once you take that to the broader organization. So I think that's kind of where Tom maybe was, what Tom was touching upon when he said that local learnings are more fragile than larger scale ones.
Yeah. I just realized that, I think the issue is that since the paper and I think our discussion has been a bit abstract on the term of learning, so we didn't talk so much, and the paper doesn't talk so much what exactly is being learned. I think I thought more about different occupations or different departments. So when I thought about localized, I didn't think about projects, so I think it makes me think that it's important to be specific on exactly what the kind of learning is in light of this, misconception, because I think it changes if you want learning to come from a project exactly and to be scaled up and shared. But it's different if you are trying to get in specific communities of experts, to share among them that they might be, physically distributed. Just think of the classic work by Julian Orr of the repair technicians at Xerox and how they were working all across the place. And the issue there was making the different experts being able to share with each other the issue. So I think that's important to think what kind of learning we are talking about.
Well, that's another layer to the whole thing that makes it more interesting, that it's not just constrained by organizational design. There's much more going on there, but we don't really see it in this paper.
Well, at the moment, I've been working more on small business owners. So I think a lot of the conversation and the discussion here is especially relatable to larger organizations. So it's a bit different. But there are definitely learning curves throughout the journey of entrepreneurship, which relate more to direct experience.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I thought was really interesting and surprising in a good way about the paper when they talk about learning curves, and they've got the formulas in there. But there's this it helped connect for me this idea that in the bigger organizations, how these routines and doing work repetitively are so important. You see this in the defense industry quite a bit, particularly in ship construction, where you have these enormous complex ships and weapon systems that are functionally integrated, and that it's very difficult for the manufacturers of these products to learn quickly or in small numbers. And so if you're making 1,000 Liberty ships or 2,000 of them, you can learn how to build one in a day or 2 or 3 days or something. But when you're building one aircraft carrier every 8 to 10 years, and a large fraction of your workforce is actually going to turn over in that time or have different jobs, that makes the learning and the focus on it quite a bit different. And I just thought, because I've read the wrapping article on learning curves and industrial production and stuff, and there's this pressure within the Navy for the shipbuilders to demonstrate learning faster, because of course that brings the price down, or should bring the price down. And not a lot of awareness that if you're building things this widely spaced in time, it has a huge impact for organizational memory and learning and what implication it has for future costs.
I was also thinking that there is one basic assumption which makes it a bit difficult to relate to entrepreneurship per se, which is the fact that beyond the role of the entrepreneur and the challenges that he or she encounters throughout the development of the business change according to the stage. So it's different. There are works on what kind of role and what kind of identity the entrepreneurs assume. And this is also accompanied by different activities, different relationships with the business. So it's a cycle of learning which is different.
So to reiterate, it seems that we are suggesting that the kind of learning, we had the case of projects versus expert community, matters. In light of Miranda's comments, we also are hitting at the fact that what kind of organization seems to matter. So I'm starting to wonder, what does it mean to talk about organizational learning in a startup, for instance?
Well, that I think identity is the key word that Miranda mentioned, that we need to distinguish between what is an organization really, and what isn't. Because if we're talking about organizational learning, we can't be talking about a company of 3 people developing stuff, right? That's individual learning.
Let's say let's talk about something like between an organization and just like 3 people together. So something like 30 people together. So a small scale, small firm. Is organizational learning, in the way it's describing the article, is still applicable there? Is there anything different?
Well, and you will like this, but I think it depends on the degree of bureaucratic development within the organization, because in order for it to be an organization that could learn, it needs to have a certain set of procedures, documents, socio-materiality, spaces, and blah, 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 all the stuff that would create these. Because learning, we can't talk about learning without talking about memory. So all the stuff that would generate memory-like characteristics needs to be there for learning to occur. Otherwise, it is going to be individual learning and not organizational learning that we'll be studying. And that's a whole different thing.
Okay. And I was going to say that in the case of a startup, now the context of which I'm coming from is that I've been part of new military commands who started up. And there's a lot that's inherited, from the organizational memory of the broader military enterprise, if you will. So that group of 30 in in my case, it's 60, somewhere between 60 and 100. They have to quickly self-organize in order to set up the processes of learning, if you will. There's almost a template to it, where we know that if we're going to start a new organization, there are going to be, it's going to have a human resources director. It's going to have an intelligence. It's going to have an operations. But more importantly, there's a whole culture associated with how all of these elements are going to interact. And so when we start up a cadre to start this new command, there's a lot of understanding of what it takes to bring a cadre up to the being the founding of a whole new command that's going to grow to however many hundred or thousand people and take on particular missions. So in essence, they're drawing off of the organizational memory of the broader enterprise on how to stand up. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and I wish I mentioned that when Ralph was talking about learning curves, and they kind of coming back to the paper, but they mention it in passing, the embodied nature of learning and memory. Specifically in your example, what I was talking about, stickiness, that it's sticking to the individuals, that I don't know who the people are in the example, but presumably they're all coming from rather similar backgrounds, and then they have an embodied way of how to approach organizing. Things may include, rituals.
Right. There's an expectation of what, there's a clear vision of what the end looks like after all of the starting up is done, which sort of helps frame for those who have not been in those types of organizations very long, like maybe it's their first ever assignment, their entry level. They have some place to plug into because the experienced members of the cadre they're basically importing the culture. And even though the organization's going to be new and there'll be some things that are unique about it, there's enough that's drawing from the broader enterprise culture that, it all ultimately works out in the end, despite all the bumps.
Right. And so there is substance essentially amongst these 30 or however people. But if we just take 30 people off the street randomly, there's not going to be that. I mean, chances are that there's not going to be the substance into which things could be learned.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So, and I think, Pedro, wink, wink, the structures of collaboration are very important if we're going to be talking about whether organizational learning can or cannot occur.
So it's interesting. So it seems that having a backdrop of, structures made it more formal, more informal, it's important for learning to take place. We have to learn from a certain standpoint, so to speak. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Well, if it's organizational learning that we're talking about, there needs to be an organization. Because, it's very easy to fall into this, to stop treating this as a metaphor or a concept and start thinking of it in intuitive sense. As we know from being humans with a memory and a learning capacity, right. And kind of just juxtaposing that upon collective processes, which in no way or sense have to resemble what we experience as individuals.
Yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely. They don't have to be. And there's this very human tendency to humanize or anthropomorphize those kinds of things because that's what we're familiar with.
Question is, what is an organization then? I have my ideas, but can we consider a book club an organization if it meets every week and has a set of routines and someone that is the leader of the thing, or even our podcast, So would that be enough to qualify as an organization?
I would say yes.
Well, if we take our podcast.
Yeah, let's use our podcast as an example. Yeah. Go ahead, Demetrius.
Yeah. Yeah, because we started off, the four of us with virtually just, no structure as such. Mm-hmm. And we have now developed into the eight of us with the division of labor, with certain bureaucratic mechanisms for organizing or, we even have a succession mechanism for, seasoned mm-hmm. leader role and so on and so forth. So we have certainly become more of an organization. But, just even talking about, I don't think it's helpful to say what is or what isn't an organization in this kind of, I think it stinks of absolutism, and we don't want to define at the exclusion of other things what is or what isn't an organization. I think there has to be sensitivity to whether it functions as an organization would, mm-hmm. or in the role of organizing for whoever it is an organization for. So if a book club meets every week but doesn't really serve organizational purposes, it's not an organization by consequences of what it does. On the other hand, a podcast of just less than 10 people, if it functions in this sense and has the consequences of being an organization, then yeah, why not? Why wouldn't it be? But I mean, I guess that I also concede that this is a very relativistic approach to it. But kind of where I'm coming from is if it matters to members in a sense that an organization would, then yeah, it is. And let's study it. And if it doesn't fit the accepted template, maybe we can learn something from it. But if it's just, you know, a registered organization, like a formal organization, but there's only like a handful of people there who never talk to one another, then that's not really interesting in the same kind of way. And I think this is going to be more important as we kind of move to these more distributed algorithmic management organizations of the future, that what we understand to be an organization is going to change dramatically, and we're going to have lots of discussions about that.
Oh, absolutely. It's like an existential concern, yeah, about what really is an organization.
In just the last thing on that in our symposium, episode 40, part one was Natalia Levina's keynote, and she was talking exactly about this. Basically, do we still need organizations in era of algorithmic automation and kind of big data and that kind of thing? So that's an interesting take on that. And if you haven't listened to that, please go back and do so right after this discussion.
And that's all for part two of episode 42. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Levitt and March's organizational learning paper here on Talking About Organizations.